Hello, and welcome to the season finale of the Super Mercado Brothers Video Game Music Podcast.
Thank you so much for joining us for episode 250. This is the podcast where we share and discuss the very best in video game music. My name is Carl Brueggemann.
And I'm, once again, his brother, Will Brueggemann. We're so delighted today, sort of in fitting tradition with how we like to cap off our seasons. We have a wonderful exclusive interview with a very successful and renowned video game composer.
Yeah, a composer that we've actually played multiple times on the podcast, talked about him over the years, been big fans for a while, so this is very exciting for us.
Yes, today's episode is going to be all about Disaster Piece.
Yeah, his real name is Rich Vreeland, and he's a composer that you probably know his work from games such as Fez or Hyper Light Drifter. He's done a lot of awesome work. The first thing I ever heard from him was actually just a solo album that wasn't the soundtrack to any game. He did actually go on to not only score video games, but films, too. He scored a film called It Follows, which was very well received, and the music was fairly critically acclaimed. So he's having a wonderful career, and we have a really interesting and fun chat with him later on. So what we're going to do before we get to that interview, to introduce some of you to his music, in case we have some listeners that are not familiar with Disaster Piece, let's give you a little bit of a crash course before we start that interview.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, for those of you that have been with us for a long time, you'll sort of know our formula here. When we have interview episodes, in addition, because you know it's such a great insight to get to talk to composers, but we also want to get to spend time, since we're doing an episode about Disaster Piece, to actually play some of his music and to talk about it and analyze it in the way that we do every week here on the show. So I think it's, in addition to that interview, which you can look forward to, I'm just excited to get to go through some of this music, especially because for us, you know, recording this now, this is after we've had that discussion with Rich. So it's, it puts a little bit of a different context on how you experience music going forward.
So the play-in track you guys heard was from Fez. That was called Adventure. That's the first track on the soundtrack. And what we're going to do is we're going to stay in the world of Fez for a little bit longer, and we're going to play one more piece of music and kind of discuss the musical tone for this game a little bit. Let's take a listen to a track called Beacon, composed by Disaster Piece. Awesome piece of music. You guys are listening to Beacon from the very beloved soundtrack to Fez. This is composed by Disaster Piece, real name of Rich Vreeland. I really enjoy, there's a lot of things I enjoy about his compositional style, but one thing that crops up time and time again is his use of pitch bend. He'll have a sustaining note that will have a surprising way of kind of pitch bend. And what it does is it really kind of solidifies the vibe and the atmosphere of the track. And to me, the connotation that I have is it reminds me of like an 80s VHS player, you know, where like the sound gets a little bit off like that. So it's definitely something that feels for some reason kind of 80s to me, but it,
pitch bend all the time would happen with old analog media, whether vinyl records or
part of the vibe of listening to analog music is some of those, you know, some of those little artifacts and things like that happen. And I think it's cool.
I think on a musical level, what it forces you to do is it sets a little bit of a different tone, because since the whole field, you know, the sonic field can get kind of warped and distorted, you're sort of listening to other and different things. And I think that to some extent epitomizes his style as a composer, just in terms of the aesthetics, that it's this very rich atmospheric music that's very emotional, but it's being done with a lot of these synth sounds that also evoke a kind of 1980s quality to them.
Sure.
And so I think it's, I mean, it's kind of like the blending of two different genres, but there's so much more context that goes in to this music, because even though it has this sort of like almost chip music sound to the actual timbre of the instruments, the way it's produced and the type of composition
is so
couldn't
different.
Be farther. Yeah,
yeah, from, I think, you know, Will, I think you really hit the nail on the head. I think one of the things that people, and I would include myself in this, really are drawn to with Disaster Piece's music is that it feels familiar to us, maybe from a sound point of view. You hear a lot of these chip sounds and these chiptune sounds that we've heard before. But the way that he's approaching it creating this, you know, this lush bed of sounds and this atmosphere in a way that is so different from most of that music that we hear, whether it's video games or even modern chiptuners. I mean, his approach is so unique. When you're listening to Disaster Piece, it's so clear that it's him. And I think that's definitely one sign of a really great artist is someone who has a singular voice. So when you're listening to their music, you can always tell it's them. I personally love that. And that's, to me, at least with a lot of his work, that's kind of what happens to me. This is an example we're going to move to next where that's not the case. This is him trying to, you know, put on a completely different hat. This is so delightful. We're going to move on to a track from Monsters Ate My Birthday Cake. And what was really cool about his work on this game is he decided to go back to something that was a bit of an homage of things that inspired him. It's kind of an SNES-esque album mixed with some other, you know, maybe more modern samples, but it definitely feels 16-bit and it feels retro. It feels very nostalgic.
Well, and the soundtrack is dedicated to Koji Kondo, isn't that correct?
That is correct, yeah. This is a wonderful soundtrack, and one reason why I think it's so delightful is that it couldn't be more different from most of his work, and I guess from the classic Disaster Piece sound.
Sure, so, I think something so many composers value, and I think, Carly, maybe you and I could speak to this on some level, is the idea that one of the most fun things as a composer is to challenge yourself by doing something completely different than anything you've done before.
Yeah, for
and
sure.
To me, that's kind of what this is. I mean, I think the fact that it's sort of going back to his roots and childhood and everything is one aspect to it. But I imagine a big part of the appeal of doing something like this is precisely what you said earlier, just how contrasting it is from the types of songs and the types of pieces he's done for games before.
A lot of love was put into this. You can hear it in the music. Let's play one track. I recommend checking out this whole thing. You guys should definitely go on Bandcamp and get this. It's delightful. So let's take a listen to Man People Village from Monsters Ate My Birthday Cake. That doesn't put a smile on your face, I don't know what will. That's Man People Village from the wonderful soundtrack to Monsters Ate My Birthday Cake, composed by Disaster Piece. And what I think is so fun about this album, and when you listen to the whole thing, you'll definitely hear this, is it's nostalgic in some ways, in a vague way. It doesn't just remind me of Super Nintendo, it reminds me of old DOS games as well. There's even some of this that kind of reminds me of maybe N64. It's definitely a throwback to old school video game music. But what's cool is when you listen to it, it's not, you can't quite put your finger on like, oh, this is Super Nintendo, oh, or this is that. It's kind of this hybrid of different sounds, and even compositionally too, it seems a little bit more of a hybrid, but it's super delightful stuff.
Well, I think it's also, it's using kind of that, especially, you know, the Super Nintendo sort of sound to really evoke kid-friendly music, almost cartoon music. And the chord progression feels, very kind of Kondo-esque.
It sure
does. But the instruments even more kind of seem to represent the aesthetic of almost like a children's TV show. And I think that's sort of the way in with this. I think a lot of those instruments and sounds are very nostalgic to a lot of us, and they remind us of our childhood. So I think there's that kind of connotation where it's not just about sounding like Mario or sounding like the Super Nintendo, but it's about using the aspects of that that reinforce kind of the idea of childhood. Because I think so much of that piece is built around kind of nostalgia. I mean, in terms of the composition, in terms of the emotion that it just kind of elicits with that chord progression, but also just those instruments in general. I mean, they remind me of like, I don't know, the kind of thing you would hear on like Sesame Street.
Absolutely. Well, now we're going to move on to a soundtrack that I guess to me feels a little bit more classic disaster piece, but we're going to play a piece of music that even in that soundtrack feels like very much a standout. This is a little bit mischievous. This is Sticky Sewers from the soundtrack Famaze. Let's take a listen. Wonderful. You guys are listening to Sticky Sewers. What a perfect musical representation of that by Disaster Piece from Famaze. One thing that I will say, this was released around the same time as Fez. And I know Fez is way more popular of a soundtrack, but I actually think his work on Famaze is very much up there with his work on Fez. I think there's some amazing tracks on this. This was definitely not something that I was familiar with before kind of, maybe digging into Disaster Piece to prepare for this finale. And I got to say that this soundtrack to me was kind of a diamond in the rough.
Sure. Well, you know what I think is interesting about his music is that there tends to be the idea of, and we hear this in a lot of music, of like an ostinato or a repeating idea. It's kind of a common device in a lot of his music.
For sure.
But what I just sort of found interesting, you know, after speaking to him, learning a little bit that he kind of had a guitar background.
Right.
It starts to make sense compositionally. A lot of these ideas, they're kind of like guitar riffs in nature, even though I imagine this probably wasn't composed on guitar, but I think that's kind of his hook, because a lot of his tunes don't necessarily always have these kind of thematic melodies, but the melodic elements are sort of built into those riffs and
those ostinati. Yeah, that's a good point, Will. That definitely is something that in some ways sets his music apart from other video game music, is because maybe it is more approached from maybe like a guitarist's point of view as opposed to a keyboardist's point
of
view.
Or at the very least, just kind of a modern production perspective. It's very, I guess, Western.
Yeah,
it reminds me of a lot of television music and film music.
Well,
composers.
I think there's one musical outside of games, one musical genre that is heard in his music pretty consistently in its minimalism, having a singular ostinato or riff continuing for a long time, and how that's mutated and distorted, and how other elements
right.
are
I
added
mean, even
on
earlier
top
when
of
you
it.
Were talking about the pitch bend, yeah, the mm-hmm. idea yeah. is it's not about the fixed notes themselves. It's
right.
sort of about how they're altered and
where
how they're
go.
Juxtaposed against each other.
Well, guys, I think this is a perfect time as ever to move on to our interview with the man behind the music, Rich Vreeland, also known as Disasterpiece. We are very excited to be joined today by Disasterpiece, Rich Vreeland, with us to talk about his wonderful career. Rich, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, it's a real honor and a pleasure for both of us, because not only have we been, you know, big fans of your music for years, but, you know, we've featured a great variety of your music on our podcast over the years. So
that's true.
I'm sure it's exciting, you know, for some of our listeners to get to have this one-on-one, or I guess two-on-one interview with you.
Ganging up on me.
We'll try to go easy on you. Well, yeah, if we can we start from the beginning? Can you talk about your musical background? I'm sure you've talked about this many times over the years. Your background in music, as well as your history with video games.
Sure. So I grew up in a musical family. My stepfather growing up was the music director of our church, and, you know, they have band practice in the basement of our house. So I used to go down there and play the drum set, and my mom sang and played the piano, and my sister always sang. So I kind of grew up around that. I didn't really get involved with music until high school.
Sure.
When I started playing guitar, taking guitar lessons. And around the same time, I started messing with software and starting to write little ideas and things. And my first sort of passion, as far as interests go, was design, graphic design. So that was kind of the path that I was heading down, and I was in college for that. And all the while, I was getting more and more into writing music. And after the first year of studying design, I actually decided to drop out and pursue music instead. That was probably early 2005 that happened. So I was maybe 19.
It seems like maybe a kind of a life-changing moment then for you.
Yeah, it was a big shift, because I had kind of planned and thought that I was going to be a graphic designer, and that was my future. And I had spent years, focused on that sort of work, and doing, building websites and things like that.
Sure.
But yeah, I just kind of decided, I was in a weird predicament at my university, where I was kind of in the wrong major, I thought, and I kind of was in like a Bachelor of Science that had a graphic design sort of slant to it, and I wanted to be...
Oh, interesting.
I wanted to do more of a creative
right.
thing. And there was a long waiting list. I was kind of I don't really feel like waiting 2 years to switch, so...
Right.
I applied to music school, and a year later, I got in and went to school for music. And around the same time, my first game that I ever worked on was something that had been posted on a message board. It's kind of like a wanted ad.
Right.
And I had been writing music on my own. In the beginning, I was just recording stuff. But I was struggling a lot to make recordings that I thought sounded good. Mm-hmm. As you do when you have no idea what you're doing.
Was the thought ever around that time that the type of music you were making would be apt for a video game? And was there any sort of game music influence at all with your style at that time?
Yeah, I think in a certain way, video games played a large role in my coming to music, because, as a 17, 18-year-old, I was really into video games at that point in time. I had started discovering that there are people writing, people who were creating arrangements of classic video game music, which I thought was cool. And also, I discovered that people were creating new music using old video game hardware, which I thought was wild at the time. I thought that was so cool. And that really kind of motivated me to start writing music. And it also kind of lent itself to me getting into a certain... being inspired by a video game sort of sound or
Right.
Or compositional style.
When did the name Disaster Piece come into play for you?
I was probably like 18. And since I was young, I always liked to create fictional company names, fictional, you know, come up with logos, things like that. So I had this like habit of like coming up with band names and then, you know, trying to flesh out the artwork and everything. And so around that time, as I was just starting to like make music and stuff, I was thinking about, you know, maybe I'll join a band or something. And so this was kind of a name that I came up with at that time. And I think I was thinking that, you know, it would be a band.
right.
And, you know, I think I lucked out in that the name is not totally juvenile.
Well, it's actually not too late. It could be a band.
Well, a lot of people think it's a band because people often refer to me as plural, which is kind of
right.
funny.
Well, I actually think I thought that at the time, just because it's such a solid name and it's like a really cool entity. I think, yeah, you mean you are sort of lucky that it has a certain level of, I guess, gravitas to it, especially considering, you know, doing films and games and things outside of just what your 18-year-old self could have imagined.
Totally. I never would have imagined that a name I came up with in, you know, when I was 18 would still stick, because pretty much everything else I did when I was 18 did not stick. So
absolutely. Well, moving into some of your beloved work in games, Fez is an incredible soundtrack and very beautiful, and it perfectly encapsulates the uniquenesses of your chip music. Can you take us back and discuss how you got involved with that game and your experience working on it, and I guess the impact that it's had on your career?
So I mean, I you know, at that point in time in my career, I was primarily, I started doing work for hire in the game space. And that was kind of a separate entity to me, because for the most part, that meant working on casual games. And, you know, I was doing some, what else was I doing around that time? I was doing some contract work for like Telltale Games and things like that. So that music was very, very much to me at the time removed from Disaster Piece. And I saw it as a separate entity. But then I was also doing original chiptune type stuff on my own. And, you know, I was starting to do little projects, little like independent games, you know, with pixel graphics and stuff, you know, as a way to, I guess, cultivate the practice of doing chip music. I was also playing shows at that time. At that time, I was living in Boston, and there was a collective of artists there called Boston 8-Bit that used to play lots of shows in Boston, but also we would go out to other cities sometimes and play.
Were you performing original Disaster Piece music or not?
Yeah, all original music. So in like the fall of 2010, we were invited to play a show in Montreal called Toy Company. And so we drove from Boston to Montreal and we played the show. And the programmer for Fez was at the show and saw my set, and came up to me after my set and introduced himself. And we just started talking and kind of hit it off. And I was familiar actually with Fez at that time, because the game had already been in development for years and had already won some awards. And, you know, there was a lot of hype around that game. They had expressed interest in having me involved as part of kind of like a compilation type approach to the soundtrack, where, you know, there'd be contributions from a lot of different musicians.
But that idea was eventually scrapped.
Well, I pushed pretty hard against the idea during our conversation. Like I thought the game would benefit from having a singular voice, and I guess they took that to heart. And you know, I also was really stoked, and I just, as soon as I got home, I started writing music and sending it to them. And it seemed to be a really kind of symbiotic relationship.
Well, absolutely. I think especially with creating an original score, having a singular voice, it's just so important, really, in any medium, having the clarity of the musical artist. I think a lot of times that happens in this industry so much with sort of remixed or rearranged scores, where you get, you know, a collection of remixers together to sort of each pay tribute to a beloved thing. But yeah, that
was absolutely the right choice in Fez, because it really did sort of establish this atmospheric yet beautiful kind of tone that is really, I think, a lot of people's impression of the game itself.
Yeah, I think it's just harder to create, you know, when you're trying to go a little heavier with things. I think it's harder to do that when you're writing as a committee or, like, you know, doing a compilation sort of approach. I think compilation music tends to be overall, tends to have a lighter tone to it.
Right.
You know, the game is not made by a bunch of different people. You know, it's made by, like, two, you know, a couple of people. So I think it kind of fit well into the kind of the vibe of the game.
Well, speaking of that vibe, you have been fortunate to work on many different projects that are kind of paying homage to an older era of video games, and that was definitely the case with Hyper Light Drifter, moving ahead a few years to, I believe this came out in 2016. We really loved your score to this game, particularly your use of ethereal synth sounds combined with, at some points, acoustic instruments. I think it creates this timeless ambiance that I don't think is going to be dated anytime soon. So what was your primary goal with this score?
Oh, thanks. My intention with Hyperlight Drifter, I kind of knew that in some ways it was going to be a spiritual successor for me to what I did on Fez. And I kind of had framed it that way for myself. You know, and a lot of the other projects I had done, I didn't see it that way at all. But I thought there were, you know, there are certainly similarities there. So, you know, starting from that point, you know, and just thinking about, you know, what is quite different about Hyperlight Drifter than Fez. And, you know, the way that you play the game, it kind of has a, as much as Fez is, has sort of a descriptive kind of emotional quality to it, I think Hyperlight is kind of a darker, heavier game. And there's more, like, momentum and, you know, there's more building that happens just as far as the way you progress through the world.
Sure.
Fighting enemies, etc. So I knew that I wanted to do something that was more kind of reserved as far as, like, you know, Fez has a lot of short tracks that, you know, have really strong melodies.
Definitely more catchy stuff.
Yeah, Hyperlight is a lot more slow building and kind of thinking about, like, a really large dynamic range where things can be really quiet and kind of whispery to, you know, basically going as hard and as heavy as possible. So I saw it as, like, you know, I wanted to do something that was really expressive and kind of captured the dynamics of the game and the world.
Sure. Well, what I think sets your music apart from other chip tuners in terms of the music we so often hear is really the lush and beautiful arrangements that you create. It's almost like an 8-bit symphony, so emotional and, you know, really atmospheric. We've used that word a lot today, but I imagine this is the element in particular that people frequently want when they hire you. Having heard your work, can you discuss how you sort of developed this sound? And I think it's sort of indicative of the two soundtracks we've sort of focused on so far.
I mean, it's easier to create lush sounding music when you're not constraining yourself to, you know, the normal limitations of chiptune music. I mean, I wouldn't really consider Hyperlight chiptune music. I mean, it's certainly, you know, that I'm certainly heavily inspired by that sort of style and sound, because that's, you know, that those are my roots, that's where I came from,
but it's kind of transcending what a chiptune can be.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like informed by those sounds, but I'm taking a much more classical approach in a couple ways, in the sense that the music is heavily inspired by film music and impressionism, and also it's inspired by, you know, expressive synth music. You know,
right.
From you know, people like Vangelis and stuff. So it's kind of pulling from a different place. And then it's certainly, you know, it's also pulling from games, from classic games, and kind of the sense of, you know, harmony in places and tone, you know, like the West and Hyperlight Drifter, like mm-hmm. that music is very much, I was very much inspired by, like, Chrono Trigger and,
yeah.
you know, Legend of Zelda. Like, there's, like, those games had a way of portraying like a mysterious forest in a very particular way that, you know, I wanted to try to recapture in my own way.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said coming from a different place. I think in general, your music, it's so clear to the listener that it's coming from this new, unique place than what we're used to hearing. But what's so great is every once in a while, at least in your video game work, we have those moments of familiarity, like paying tribute to the past. But for the most part, it's definitely coming from a different place for sure.
I mean, I think as artists, we're all like, you know, we're all riffing on things that have already happened. But, you know, I try really hard to do it in a way that is not too direct. And so I try to remember kind of the imprints that things have left on me without actually like mechanically, you know, replicating anything.
Sure. Well, you touched briefly on some of your own just solo chiptune albums, and if I'm not mistaken, my personal favorite work from yours was not an actual video game. It was your album Rise of the Obsidian Interstellar, and that was actually the very first piece of music that I was introduced to by Disasterpiece. I think it's incredible. It's this weird combination of music that's groovy and emotional and gorgeous, and it is classical, but there's also kind of these elements of like a modern electronica mixed in there. How do you approach your solo albums as opposed to games? I imagine it's more of just a raw expression of whatever you are in the mood to get out at that time.
Yeah, I think it was more of that for sure. I think pretty much my whole career, I've tried to create sandboxes for myself to kind of focus what I'm doing and limit myself in a certain way. So, you know, around the time that I was writing the album Level, which is the original album that I wrote that precedes Rise of the Obsidian Interstellar, which is similar in some ways, you know, I was also writing music for Rise of the Obsidian, and kind of listening to those tracks and like kind of placing them based on how I thought about them, you know, and it was very simple. You know, I kind of saw Level as like a concept album where every track was a level in a game. And,
sure.
And that was kind of it. You know, it was kind of intentionally ambiguous and, you know, let the imagery of the music kind of tell the story. But then I had other music that I was writing at that time that was kind of similar, but it had more, to me, it had more of a sci-fi space kind of feel to it.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that was kind of the, you know, that was really the only overarching concept for Rise of the Obsidian, is that I want to make a space concept album. And yeah, I mean, I just kind of, with that in mind, you know, I was writing music without really thinking about that album and just writing music at that time for fun. But then, you know, there were also some tracks where I was thinking about that concept, and, you know, so that definitely informed me in a certain way.
Well, it kind of sounds like to me like it was just your instincts taking over and you just having fun making music, and it really comes across that way.
Awesome. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely what it was. And I think at that time, you know, it's still pretty early in my like writing career. Like some of the songs on that record are from like 2008, 2007. You know, so I'd only been writing music for a couple of years, and so I'm still kind of like learning the language and you know, exploring techniques that I'd never messed with before. So, you know, it's kind of an athletic album. There's a lot of like movement and there's a lot of technical stuff, you know, there's a lot of time signature changes and metric modulation and key changes,
right.
And you know, it's kind of nerdy music, but
it's very proggy music.
Yes, it's very proggy.
Well, I think one of the themes that we keep touching on here again and again is really your versatility as an artist. Shoot Many Robots is, to me, one of the standout soundtracks in your career thus far, partially because it is so wildly different from your other work. Can you talk about your background in rock and blues music and how your approach might change or not change for a score like this as opposed to like a chiptune score?
Yeah, that was an interesting project. It kind of checked a lot of boxes for me at the time. It was really my first opportunity to work at a game studio out of college.
Oh, wow.
It was my first opportunity to work as a sound designer, too. So, you know, I was at the game studio, this game studio, Demiurge, in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm.
I was there every day for almost a year, you know, full time. And I was doing music, I was doing sound design, I was doing all the implementation of the sounds. So, I, you know, it was a really good exploratory period for me to figure out, you know, what do I like to do? Do I like making sound effects every day? And generally, the answer to that was no.
good to know.
I think it depends, but it was a lot of robot sounds, so I kind of got fatigued on that. But you know, musically, that was an opportunity for me to kind of go back to. You know, I said that chip music was my roots, but like doing like distorted guitar riffs is kind of my actual roots. Like that's the first.
Oh, cool.
That's the first thing that I got really into. You know, growing up. You know, in high school, I listened to a lot of Tool and Rage Against the Machine.
Nice.
So that was kind of my baseline. And so to do a project like that we kind of decided that the aesthetic needed to be kind of like a gritty blues-inspired rock sound meant that I got to kind of pick up my guitar again, which I probably hadn't been playing as much since I graduated college, and you know, get back into that space of like. You know, tuning my guitar down to drop D and
oh yeah,
playing lots of power chords and
dirty rock. Yeah, so because it's similar to your roots, but also so different from, you know, the brand Disaster Piece that we've come to know. Do you, in your mind, separate that? Does that feel like Disaster Piece to you, or does that feel like working for another company?
I mean, it feels like Disaster Piece to me, and I think it. I really value those projects that are explicitly different. Or different in a much stronger way that anybody can notice. Because I think, you know, I think there's a tendency because the, you know, most of the well-known stuff that I've done has been kind of this expressive synth type music. I mean, that's kind of what people, you know, that's kind of what people classify me as. But, you know, I don't see myself as a chiptune artist or as an electronic primary, you know, I don't see myself as like primarily a synth artist and certainly not like an 80s artist.
I mean, it's just instrumental music, and you're choosing to use synthesizers as, you know, your timbre of choice.
Yeah, I mean, I don't even see myself as an instrumental artist. I see myself as an artist who, you know, wants to do lots of different things, and you know, and that's, it's just that I certainly have certain things that I feel like I've put more time and effort into, and so those are the things that stand out. But I mean, I
right,
like on a project I'm doing right now, a feature film, you know, I've been arranging for live musicians and, you know, doing reimaginings of old pop songs, you know, so there's,
oh,
like,
that's great,
doing vocals and working with string players and, you know, just doing different stuff. And that's kind of been, to me, like from the inside, that's been the seed that connects all my work, is that like I'm always trying to challenge myself and push myself in new directions.
Right.
And so I that's the way that I look. That's the way that I see every project, is an opportunity to do something new and exciting.
Do you feel like in terms of production and your arrangements that there is some common craft or skill that you've gained over the years that contributes to that sound, even in, you know, music of vastly different genres?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think having most of my music start with two things: writing a lot of music that's centered around riffs and you know, time oriented, and then getting into chip music, which kind of forces you to think about music in individual voices.
Yeah,
kind of like traditional counterpoint.
Part writing, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, having those two things kind of be the basis of, you know, where I started. I mean, those have always informed my music, I think. You know, I'm always thinking about the way that the musical lines interact with each other. And so over time, you know, as I was doing more and more chip music, that was the direction that I pushed myself towards, you know, as far as building up a vocabulary, a compositional vocabulary. Because, you know, you can only kind of push in certain directions when you're limited sonically.
Right.
And for a while, I wasn't really pushing that much on the production side of things. You know, I was really focused on composition. So, you know, I think I've kind of developed, you know, a certain sound at this point that where, you know, over time I've just picked up certain techniques and certain sounds that I like, certain voicings, certain, you know, progressions, etc. And that's kind of like helped me to, and sometimes it limits me, but I mean, it's
right,
also helped me to establish a certain kind of like sonic identity.
Absolutely. And you mentioned a little bit about your work on film, which I'm really curious about. We were delighted by the score to It Follows, which I believe was your first score to a feature-length film. And one of the things that was particularly surprising and delightful to us was how much of your unique style shines through in that score. It really does sound like classic disaster piece, and it has those elements that we've been talking about for the past 10 minutes. What was your experience like drawing influence from things like video games and some of those synth artists maybe that you were influenced by, but utilizing it in a film?
Yeah, it was a really interesting process. I really wanted to work on a feature, and that was kind of the first opportunity that had come along that seemed legitimate. And even so, I had already signed on to do a bunch of work, and so I really had to be pushed to take that project. But one of the most interesting things about working on that film is that the temp score for the film, you know, the music that they used to cut the picture together, the temp score had a lot of music from Fez in it. So I was put in this kind of unusual position where, you know, they had been cutting the film to other music. And so the music that was in there, you know, they kind of had established a relationship to it on a certain level. And so, you know, I was basically coming in after that and trying to distill down, you know, the ideas of the temp score into new music.
Right.
Without copying it, obviously. Just trying to, like, distill it down into an idea or an adjective and then build it back up.
Well, and that it's music that you've already composed with a completely different context that you have with it.
Yeah, it was super weird to hear, you know, like, there are probably four or five Fez tracks in the temp score. And it was just, you know, at first it was really strange to hear those in the film because it didn't make sense to me at all. But, you know, over time I started to get it. And, but, you know, I had built up this process of, okay, I'm going to do my best to, like, be inspired by the temp score, but not, you know, not be attached to it so that I can still write new music. And I think for the most part that worked really well. You know, I was able to, like, pull influence from a lot of sources that I wouldn't normally pull from or didn't have, you know, hadn't really listened to, you know. So there was music from, you know, like Krzysztof Penderecki and John Cage, John Carpenter,
right?
People like this in the temp score, and that was great because that really took me in new directions. But then, like, having to work off of my own music was challenging, and it created some issues because the director, you know, he really liked the Fez music is the reason that he reached out to me in the first place. So it proved difficult at times because there would be certain tracks where, you know, I wrote something new kind of based on the, you know, what the Fez track was doing in the score, the temp score.
Sure.
And he, you know, he would like it, but it wasn't
Fezzy enough.
Right, exactly. Like, it wasn't working as well for him as the Fez track. And so, you know, a couple of those tracks, I felt like I was able to bring it to a new place that worked better for the film. But there were one or two cues where the things that I had tried, he didn't seem to like as much. And I kind of had to, you know, because of time constraints and things, I kind of had to go back on my laurels a little bit and kind of take one for the team.
Sure.
So there's one or two cues in that are pretty similar to music from Fez, and then I just, you know, made little adjustments to kind of do my best to, you know, walk the fine line of, you know, making someone else happy, but also make it so that it's not so similar.
Well, I imagine that's a great experience, and I mean, even just to know that you're amongst great company. I mean, there's just so many stories of film composers and directors having disagreements. I mean, Jerry Goldsmith in particular is a name who comes to mind, where oftentimes sort of a similar situation where his music would from another film would be temped in there, and then he would have disagreements about the style, and they would end up wanting to use and license his music from an entirely different film and use it out of context. But I imagine that's a good experience to have, even though it sounds like it's very frustrating.
It was good. I mean, it's just been part of my education in how films are made.
Well, and you sort of, you're falling in right on what feels like a little bit of
like a popular subgenre in film music with these synth-based scores, thinking of like the Daft Punk score to Tron, or I mean even recently this summer with that Stranger Things soundtrack that became very popular, it almost seems like that's something that's kind of becoming popular again.
A synth renaissance,
I suppose. I mean, we didn't choose to do synth for any sort of like particular reason.
Mm-hmm.
We actually were planning to do more of a hybrid score, but we had certain constraints. We thought we'd have half a year to do the score, and then we only had like a month. So
oh wow.
So, you know, in that time period, the only thing I felt like I could probably do is do a synth score.
That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, because at that point, you know, I'm very sensitive to doing the same thing twice. And so my initial plans for It Follows were to do something completely different. And then, you know, it kind of had to be reeled back in because of the real life situation, both
sure.
time limitations and then also, you know, what David wanted. And you know, David's attachment to the Fez soundtrack. So
for sure. Yeah. Well, if we can move back into the game sphere, there's a lot of game soundtracks that I'm really interested in talking to you about, and a lot of different approaches. One of the things that I admire about you is there's so many different games where you have this. It seems like you have this idea from the onset of approaching and setting these interesting limitations. Like off the hand, you know, I'm thinking of an example like Mini Metro, where the music was composed in a very novel and unique way. One of our favorites that we discovered not too long ago was your score to Monsters Ate My Birthday Cake, which we just absolutely gushed over. Can you talk, maybe if we can hone in on that, can you talk a little bit about maybe your inspiration for the music of that game, as well as the process of implementing that retro soundtrack?
Yeah, that's nice to talk about that because it doesn't come up often. That game, I thought, had a very, certainly was paying very strong homage to games like Zelda and Yoshi's Island and things like that. So.
Right.
You know, I thought it would
be... The Koji Kondo influence in the soundtrack is very apparent.
Yeah, I mean, I thought it would be a good opportunity to kind of, you know, get on the wagon, so to speak, and find my own way to kind of pay tribute to the people that came before me and the people that had a big impact on, you know, my career in a certain way. So for me, that was, you know, that was Koji Kondo for sure. And then, you know, there's definitely some nods to other composers and some of my friends who I kind of came up with. Like, you know, someone like Ida Ksuka, who we ran a chiptune net label together for about 6 years. And then he went on to do the soundtrack to Spelunky and a bunch of...
Oh, that's a great soundtrack. Yeah, he's great.
Yeah, he's awesome. A bunch of Lombard games, Downwell, etc. And in that journey, there was a little bit of exploration and experimentation as far as, you know, what's the sound of this game, but also, you know, how can I kind of channel this intention to pay tribute in a way that is interesting and supports the game. And, you know, it ended up being an approach on a couple of levels. Kind of aesthetically, I had a strong intention to create a lot of these, like, a lot of sampled instruments to kind of give it a Super Nintendo...
Like the Super Nintendo, sure.
Yeah, like a Super Nintendo kind of sound, but more contemporary. So, you know, creating... You know, there's definitely Super Nintendo samples in the soundtrack, but I also wanted to create my own that were kind of inspired by it. And, you know, there's a certain quality to those sounds, a kind of a lightness.
Yeah.
There tends to not be a lot of... I mean, there are certainly Super Nintendo games that have, like, a lot of bass and are muddy, but I wanted it to be light and crisp, so... And very dry.
Well, there's an example early on in the soundtrack, maybe the first or second track, where you hear this SNES harp that's very familiar, but then there's this upright bass sample that's distinctly modern. And hearing that combination together was just delightful because you can tell you're listening to something new and fresh.
Oh, that's awesome. I mean, I didn't even really... I guess I wasn't even thinking about the time period of when those sounds are from. I just kind of heard them. I thought they sounded good together. And that harp sound was funny because I didn't even think it sounded like a harp that much. I ended up using it as a piano, kind of.
Oh, sure.
Which was kind of a weird thing.
Well, that's something that would happen all the time in that era. There's this kind of ambivalency of what the sounds are supposed to be, because even though it is using samples, what's being sampled is this kind of primitive general MIDI noises that, yeah, there is this
ambiguity there. I think there's a really interesting parallel with this soundtrack to some of your synth music in terms of how you described that maybe the instruments and to some extent the style are influenced by music of that era, yet the arrangements are more elaborate and sophisticated. I definitely get that sense with this game as well, even though some of the instrument choices and to a great deal, you know, some of the compositional gestures are influenced from the 16-bit era. Some of the arrangements felt a little bit more contemporary, or like they were influenced by pop music or genres outside of video games. And I really enjoyed hearing those instruments being put to use in more of kind of a legitimate sonic arrangement.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly music that I wrote in the game that's very directly inspired by music from other games. You know, one of the gameplay tunes for the first world, you know, is very clearly inspired by the title music from Wind Waker.
Sure.
But then there's a lot of music in the game that is actually orphaned ideas of mine from over the years that I never found a place for. And, you know, I kind of justified to myself that this game would benefit from a kind of an eclectic compositional style where, because there's so many different characters and it's kind of light and fun, that it would work to kind of source all different kinds of musical ideas and just, you know, kind of put them all into this palette. And so,
sure,
you know, there's ideas in there that are very kind of minimalistic, almost in like a Steve Reich kind of sense. And then there's ideas that are, mm-hmm. you know, I pulled some stuff that I had written on guitar, so that, you know, there's some kind of proggy moments in the score.
Oh yeah.
So I mean, it's very eclectic in a way, but you know, also trying to reel that in by, you know, I built a library of sounds that I kind of reused intentionally to kind of homogenize it in a certain way.
Well, if we can continue talking in the world of samples, one thing I'm really interested in is talking about your approach to Gunhouse. It's very heavily reliant on loops and samples. Can you talk a bit about what makes this soundtrack stand out from your catalog? And in your opinion, how does the finished product compare to what your expectations were when you decided to put this limitation or, you know, to approach the score in this way?
Yeah, this was kind of an interesting project. Every once in a while, a project comes along where I feel like there's a certain openness to what could work for it. And for this project, I sensed that, you know, it needed to be fun and groovy and have energy to it. And beyond that, it could kind of be whatever.
Sure, I can see that.
So, you know, that was really empowering as far as just kind of exploring. And so, yeah, around that time, you know, I had heard from a friend that Darren Korb, the composer who did the music for Bastion.
Right, right. Yeah, we've had him on our show before.
Okay, cool. I heard that he kind of, he used a lot of loops. And oftentimes they were kind of, they would even be central to kind of his, like, development of a song. And I thought that was kind of interesting. You know, I think there's a lot of stigma around using loops. And so I kind of wanted to do it anyway and kind of explore it and see where it would take me. And you know, it turned out to be a really fun creative process to use loops, because it, you know, it kind of gets the momentum going quicker. You know, you kind of find something, you find an interesting phrase or a sound, and then you can just kind of start building with that, and then maybe, you know, you find another phrase or loop or whatever that kind of, you know, works, you think that works well together. And so it kind of became this exercise in production. You know, a lot of the work on those tracks was just production. And, you know, what if I did this? And this is weird. You know, like, oh, here's this, like, crazy saxophone solo. You know, what can I do with this? Or, like, you know, I found, like, a loop of, like, a Chinese string instrument. And then I was like, well, you know, what can I do to this to make it different? And so, you know, like, getting in there and changing the pitches of those and then adding like a square wave to it, you know, to harmonize over it, and just, you know, just kind of doing lots of weird different kinds of stuff.
I think that's so wonderful because it's going to lead you to new, like, musical and creative possibilities that you never would have if you didn't have that approach.
Totally. I mean, I had encouragement from the developer, Brandon Sheffield, who, you know, he kind of saw what I was doing. I was using all different, you know, a lot of times these loop libraries have lots of quote unquote world sounds.
Sure.
You know, so I was like, you know, I was filling the soundtrack with things like balafone, like, you know, West African percussion and instruments from Asia, and just all different kinds of stuff, didgeridoo, like whatever I could find, you know, I was throwing it in there. And so he kind of caught on, and he was like, oh, you know, it'd be cool if you did something with gamelan. So, you know, and then I started messing with gamelan instruments, and, you know, just kind of, you know, just seeing where all those sounds kind of, you know, would take me.
Well, then coming back to just video game world, like so much of that world music has influence in games of the generation that you were sort of coming up under. I mean, you mentioned Chrono Trigger earlier, but that's one of the few video games I can think of that actually uses like gamelan samples in kind of a looped way, like that Corridors of Time track.
In a funky way too, not just a looped way, but it's a very funky, groovy example of that.
Yeah, I think the Chrono games, you know, there's a really strong world influence. There's definitely a really strong like Celtic influence in Mitsuda's music.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's also this tendency to, you know, as someone who's not well versed in like, you know, the way these instruments are actually performed or, you know, used, you kind of find yourself deconstructing those sounds and building them back up from your own perspective. And so it allows for, you know, some pretty interesting results as a result of that.
Well, what a fun experience. We have to ask this. We're just so curious. If you absolutely had to pick, what is your personal favorite soundtrack of yours thus far? It might be for musical reasons, or maybe just the experience holds a special place in your heart. If you had to pick one of your soundtracks, what would it be?
Yeah, I think I could come at it from different angles. You know, if I was saying music, you know, I might say, or experience, I might say something like Monsters Ate My Birthday Cake, which is really a really fun project.
Sure.
If I'm thinking more about experience, I might think of like Mini Metro, which for me, you know, it was a project. It was kind of something that I had been wanting to do for a long time, which is, you know, I really wanted to create a soundtrack that was as purely procedural as I could get. And
right. Yeah, your approach was very novel to that game. It was very different from your other music.
Yeah, I mean, it's not underscored in any way. It's, you know, the sounds are all kind of tied directly to the events in the game, and everything's quantized, and you can kind of create a kind of a set of parameters for every city to kind of give it a different feel. And for me, you know, the process of building a soundtrack in code as opposed to, you know, writing tracks is a very different emotional experience. It's extremely entrancing. It's like, you know, it's like working on a puzzle. And I think writing music can be a puzzle too, but it's generally, in my experience, a lot more emotionally fraught to, you know, write underscore. You know, like Hyperlight was a really emotionally tough project to work on.
Sure.
Mini Metro was not emotionally challenging at all. It was really easy to work on because it was kind of you know, I think dealing in code on some level was kind of detaching in a certain way. And then, you know, I also got to go to New Zealand, which is where the developers are from, which was fantastic.
Right. Well, and it's the kind of music that sort of is brought to life through the game, through the player's experiences, and almost sort of like creating a new medium in a sense. I remember feeling that way when I played through the game Flow, and there's that very minimal Austin Wintry score that's just almost completely responsive in almost like a sound design way through your interaction in the game. I've been noticing that more and more with video game scores, that they're becoming increasingly interactive in nature, and it's very fascinating, the musical implications, because it almost gives the player a unique experience every single time.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of great things that you can do with music that is not overtly placed to create emotion, you know, like not like underscore, like music that's more kind of woven into the world and woven into the interactions of the player. You know, I look at a game like Inside, which I think did that extremely well. You know, there's a lot of sound design in that game that also kind of fulfills the function of music, or the, you know, if there is music, it's extremely subtle, and it just kind of melts into the atmosphere of the world.
Right.
And I found that extremely effective.
Well, yeah, atmosphere is a perfect word to describe it. Well, the last thing that we really want to do, and this is something that we ask all of our composers on this show, is what advice would you have for any aspiring composers, either in the world of video games and film, or just purely on a musical level? What sort of wisdom have you gained through your career that you would have loved to hear from someone when you were just starting off?
I think what's been valuable for me is that generally I've tried to put authenticity above everything else and just really try to chase my own voice, whatever that Sure. voice may be at any given time. And I think that's really kind of the secret to, you know, to you know, being successful doing this kind of thing, is that you have to be authentically yourself, and you have to take the time to really discover and figure out what that is. And you know, if you're fortunate, people appreciate the work that you do. And the other thing is to make yourself available. You know, you don't have to advertise or anything like that. But you know, just going to events, meeting people, you know, having a good internet presence, just like, you know, just having a way that people can find you. And you know, over time, you know, you meet people, you become friends. You know, if you become friends with people, people know what you're about, they know what you do.
Yeah.
You don't really have to, you know, you don't really have to force yourself on people. You don't have to, you know, beg for work or whatever. You just need to be around. You need to be, you know, on people's on people's minds on some level.
Absolutely.
You know, and it's all about relationships. It's not really about networking. It's about relationships. It's about making friends and, you know, being genuinely yourself.
That's so wonderful, and we can definitely tell that's what you do every single project. We can't wait to hear more of your work in video games and film, and see what other creative ideas you have in store. So we wish you the best of luck with your career, and thank you so much, Rich, for taking the time to talk to us today. This was a real pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
Thanks again. Have a great rest of your day.
You too.
Well, boy, that sure was fun. I had a really great time. You know, what's interesting is a lot of the things we talked about, I mean, obviously, there's no way I could have known them before, but like I said earlier, it really sort of changed the context of how I think about his music.
Mm-hmm.
And what's fun about the idea of continuing on with this episode is that, you know, all of us and all of you kind of can now be thinking of sort of what Rich was talking about as we continue to explore some of his other soundtracks. Once again, we just want to thank him for coming on the show. It was really a pleasure, and in some ways feels sort of long overdue to have this discussion, because he's been a very prominent figure in the game music scene for the last decade, really.
That's definitely true. This felt in some ways kind of long overdue, so it was a wonderful interview. We were very fortunate to get to speak with him. So thank you so much, Rich, one more time for coming on our show and talking to us. We had a great time. And so what we're going to do to wrap this episode off, this exciting season finale, now that all of us have maybe a little bit more insight into the man behind the music, let's play a couple more pieces of music and kind of talk about some of the things maybe that were mentioned in the interview. We're going to move on to something that was mentioned, and this is means quite a bit to me. The first Disaster Piece album I ever heard. Actually, my friend Aaron, I remember on Facebook years ago, posted a track from this, and he said this was before Aaron was ever really interested in video game music. He eventually did become very interested in it, but he was like, this is really interesting. It's like kind of reminds me of Nintendo, but it's like a lot more subtle and expressive and like complex. And I was like, oh, that's cool. You're right, Aaron. This is definitely all those things. It's from his album Rise of the Obsidian Interstellar. And as we mentioned in the interview, it's just a solo album that he just made pretty much for fun. And it's a chiptune album. And this is really personifies what I said about feeling like an 8-bit orchestra.
Right.
It's these very vibey, lush arrangements. And this is kind of like this space opera themed album. So let's take a listen to one of my favorite tracks. This is Wagering Lights. We'll be right back. I love this piece of music. This part here is kind of feels like there's some Gaelic influence, doesn't it? A little bit. Sure. But in general, I think what's so great about this is it's so progressive. You know, like the section that feels like it's kind of the climax, it's in 9/8. It's this compound meter, and it's kind of a little bit hard to groove along to it. But that's what makes it so interesting, is that it kind of under the surface, it feels like, oh, this is like a very groovy track, but there's actually a lot more happening than you might expect upon first listen. And is it ever atmospheric? I mean, there's just all these sounds going all over the place. It's super lush. It's just really good background music, actually. I remember putting this album on the background when I studied, I think later part of college.
I think there's a certain element that we're used to hearing this kind of chip music sound doing something, I don't want to say predictable, but I guess confined to specific genres, specific types of expression. And I think what Disaster Piece often... what excites us about his music is that it very much defies all of that. So you have
sure.
the timbre and the aesthetics, sort of this one type of music, which you have all these nostalgic, possibly nostalgic attachments to, but it's this music that feels inherently modern.
This section here is so beautiful.
Yeah, but what I mean is that it feels modern, not just in terms of how it's produced and how kind of atmospheric and emotional it is, but just the types of chords, the types yeah. of lines he's writing, the way things are voiced, they feel kind of the benefit of the last, 10, 20 years of popular music and film music.
Well, I guess what I'll say about this track, it's just an electronic piece of music. It doesn't really have any video game elements to me at all.
Right.
And I think that's what I like about it. It's really taking its time. It doesn't have a lot to prove. It's not trying to be this short little catchy song that comes in and comes out and, washes its hands and it's done. It's really kind of exploring the space. And its track is 4 minutes, 35 seconds. And every single second of it is very exploratory. We're getting to a brand new section here after 4 minutes. So I think one of my favorite things about this album is just how much like exciting and creative ideas there are. Even in one piece of music, it feels like you're taken on a journey.
Sure. Yeah, and there's that feeling that it's all somehow like possible on a Game Boy. There's that kind of feeling that it's just like, wow, it's like using a tool that you thought was confined to one sense, but
I love it.
Exploring something more. Yeah.
Well, now let's move on to the last track of the day we're going to talk about. This is from a game that came up quite a bit, Hyper Light Drifter. Very critically acclaimed soundtrack he did. This is such an atmospheric, vibey score. It's definitely a lot less melodic and tuneful than something like Fez is, but it's super beautiful. Let's take a listen to the first track of the score. This is Vignette Panacea by Disaster Piece. What a fitting track to end the day on. This was such a awesome season finale. It's been a long time coming for sure. Always happy to shine a light on composers that we really respect. And if by some weird chance one of you out there hasn't heard of Disaster Piece, hopefully you've enjoyed this episode.
This piece is so beautiful. There's almost like hints of Debussy.
Yes, it is impressionistic, kind of like you mentioned in the interview. And it's great to hear a piano piece that we definitely. That's not what I expect from his music.
There's also something kind of cool about at first, you know, sometimes when you have piano that's very compressed with a lot of reverb, you get this kind of distortion because there's so much noise that builds up with a really big kind of reverb chain. So as I was listening to that piano, it almost sounded like you were getting that kind of distortion. But then I realized, oh no, there's this kind of like synth element that's coming in. And so it's kind of like, similar to all his music, it's using the production in a very musical way that's kind of influencing how you're meant to feel about it emotionally.
Absolutely. Well, guys, we had a wonderful time this season. This was a really fitting way to wrap up. And we're going to be back with you with our season premiere of, is it season 11? Is that what's coming next, Will?
I don't know. I've lost track.
We lost track at this point?
I guess so. That sounds right.
That's absolutely crazy.
We're definitely not past 11, so...
Well, here, there's one way to check. Yep, Original Showcase 10. That means it was the 10th time we did that. So we're wrapping up Season 10. So yeah, we'll be back with you for the premiere of Season 11. And stay tuned. We posted the first one at time of recording. We posted the first of our videos from our recent recording session of Hydrosity Act 2 from Sonic 3. So stay tuned for more of those in the future. And yeah, we're going to play you out. We're going to keep the vibes going and play you out with a track that you can just close your eyes and just fall back into the musical abyss. Here. This is Rain in C minor from Disaster Piece's score, The Floor is Jelly.
Yeah, at the time of recording, we haven't yet gone to MAGFest, but by the time you guys are listening to this, our weekend at MAGFest will have been concluded.
That's true.
So hopefully we're still alive. We're all in one piece, and I'm really looking forward to it. I know it's going to have been great.
Absolutely. All right, guys, enjoy Rain in C minor. This has been so much fun. My name is Carl Brueggemann.
And I'm his brother, Will Brueggemann. Have a great week, everybody.
Peace out.